You think Saru can make the Pavans understand why we need their transmitter?
He's got to. Convincing them to let us complete our mission is the only way.
Then we defeat the Klingons?
And the war ends.
Easy.
Easy.
When all this fighting is over, I got big plans.
I know of a place, Lake Shasta. I take a little sailboat on the water. Lake's full of trout this time of year. Ever have fresh roasted trout?
Transfer complete.
Hello and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the bridge,
this is Tyler Orton, getting into his Q robe, sitting on my throne, and sitting in judgment of everything around me.
Oh my.
Why am I sitting in judgment, Cam? What am I getting all judgmental about this week?
Well, for this week, in our, I guess, last regular episode before our best of for the year, the last regular episode of 2017, we're going to tackle the topic of, is early Star Trek ever awesome?
Yeah, we want to do a bit of a mid-season report card on Star Trek Discovery, and then we're going to have fun by analyzing how Star Trek Discovery's first 9 episodes stack up versus the first 9 episodes of all the other series, because a lot of people, I don't know, I'm very reactionary with regards to Discovery.
Star Trek fans?
This isn't real Star Trek.
Right.
I'm just wondering how great out of the gate have other series been, and we're going to have some fun with it, but why don't we start off first with a bit of a report card on Star Trek Discovery?
Yeah.
Because we've been tackling individual episodes, and I think we want to grab this as a whole and take it all in, and we'll do this, of course, for the end of the season, but this is going to be fun. So, Cam, I think the best thing that we want to jump on here is just what we're digging about the characters so far. 9 right. episodes in. Do you think Star Trek Discovery has a strong grasp of the characters? Are there characters that you're invested in that you want to see the journeys continue? Or are there just a lot of characters that you just can't stand?
I'm very excited to see where Landry goes.
You might be disappointed if you get past episode 3.
Oh, geez. Yeah. No, I mean, I think this series has done an extremely good job in pre-planning what to do with its characters. And I think that's something that any of the other series didn't do quite as well.
I think a lot of the times they were like, okay, let's cast an actor.
Yeah.
And then we'll figure out the character after we start shooting. And I think...
Or not.
Well, and that's what I think probably the biggest problem was with, say, Enterprise yes. and Voyager, is they kind of gave up on a lot of characters. Unless they really grabbed the writers right away.
Right.
Just kind of forget about them. I think with Discovery, though, they're making sure that everybody in the main cast has something to do.
Mm-hmm.
There are... Let's talk about Ash Tyler, though, because I think that's maybe the most problematic character, and that so far this guy seems... And I've said it before, he seems to be a bit of a cipher.
Right.
So it's hard to get invested with him, whereas I'm invested in the journeys of every other character that we've been introduced to in the main cast at this point. What are your thoughts on the Tyler conundrum?
Okay, podcast co-host. the thing with Ash Tyler, and I kind of addressed this in the video we did last week.
On YouTube for
right.
all those who don't subscribe to us on the YouTube feed. Find us at Subspace Transmissions.
That's right. Is that I can't tell if they're setting him up as a character who's going to have this really rich backstory going forward through however long the series goes. Like, if, say, Discovery goes 5 seasons, are we going to be seeing this Ash Tyler character over 5 seasons with this wealth of sort of backstory that could be tied into, you know, all of these kind of slow reveals we're getting? Or is he being set up as a season 1, like, plot point?
Yeah.
And that's the confusion, because if you tell me he's just a plot point, then I can go, okay, sure, like, this character makes more sense to me in what they're doing. Versus, am I supposed to really care about this character?
Well, the problem is you are supposed to invest in this character, and so far I don't find Ash Tyler to be very compelling.
Right.
And I think that it's a likable actor. I like the actor. I don't find anything wrong with him. I just don't know if he's been given enough rich material to work with here.
But is he compelling at least in the sense of what he brings out of other characters? Like, I would say what he's brought out of Burnham has been invaluable.
Okay.
And the show is very obviously centered on Burnham. So you can see how they would be setting her up for some sort of, you know, carpet being pulled out from under her.
Yeah.
For later in the season.
I just feel that's this Ash Tyler guy, not maybe one of the few misfires when it comes to characters at this point. And even if something comes to be later on in the season, I still think that the writers have failed to establish this early on as a character that we should be really caring about at this point. And so
right.
If we do want to talk about somebody that I think they've really nailed right out of the ballpark, though, is Stamets. And you and I discussed this also in the YouTube video, in which this is a guy that we see him as such a distinct personality.
Yes.
And he's going through a very distinct journey, a character arc as well. And I think this is very successful. And I just wonder how much of this was kind of pre-planned out in the series Bible, where they wanted somebody so distinct. And they've succeeded, really.
And you can look at a character like the Doctor on Voyager and see how that show took a character who's, in many of his terms of, in terms of his mannerisms and the way he approaches others, can be viewed as very unlikable, but they figure out how to have fun with them. And I feel like that's what Discovery's done really well, is when we met Stamets in Context is for Kings, I wasn't immediately like, boy, this is going to be a really fun character. Like, I can't wait to kind of hang out with this character. Whereas, as the series has gone on, I feel like he is becoming the most fun character on the show. Like, the one that you want to spend time watching, even if on paper he isn't the likable one of the bunch.
So what do you think it is about Stamets then?
I think
a lot of it's Anthony Rapp, the actor?
I think Anthony Rapp is bringing so much like unique charisma to this character.
Yeah.
And a lot of the times in previous series, they would craft these kind of unique, kind of quirky, kind of weird characters, but then not really write them interesting things to do.
Right.
You know, or, you know, we have seen Robert Beltran in Vegas many a times. He is a charismatic guy in front of a crowd, and he's really funny.
A performer.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Chakotay, on paper, is an interesting character. On paper.
He's got conflict within him.
Yes.
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 But?
Mash the two together under the, you know, the direction of 1990s TV on UPN, and Chakotay's a bore. And I think Stamets is really benefiting from just everything working sort of in his favor. He doesn't feel like a character that they're maybe struggled with once and then gave up on. Like, it feels like they just figured out how to use him and are just doing it so well.
We should also just Lorca, because this is a character that I think he's still, I like him. I think Jason Isaacs is bringing a lot to the role, but I still struggle with him in that I feel as if I don't quite know the character, in that they're hiding stuff from me, which I wonder just how well I'll get to know the character by the end of season one, and which to me could be a little bit problematic.
Right. Yeah, I'm kind of with you. I'm a little up in the air on Lorca.
Yeah.
I love Jason Isaacs in pretty much anything.
Sure.
But especially the movie The Tuxedo.
With Jackie Chan?
Yeah.
I never even saw that one.
He plays like a James Bond sort of type. It's not good. I don't even know why I brought it up. But, you know, I love Jason Isaacs. I think the idea of the sort of tragic or kind of morally dubious captain is a really cool idea. And I wished the show had as much interest in exploring him as much as maybe some of the other series did with their captains. Like, I feel like he's a very poorly defined captain 9 episodes in. Like, I understand his sort of his trauma, and his, you know, we know there's machinations going on that aren't being revealed to us, you know, that will be revealed later, but he doesn't have that strong personality the other captains have had.
It's interesting that you pose it that way, because I don't feel quite that strongly about my criticisms of him, because I think a lot of it benefits from Jason Isaac's performance, where I think
he's great,
bringing a lot to that character. To me, it just comes down, and I don't think it's paper-thin characterizations. It's more just motivations in that.
Well, they seem to clash sometimes, you know, episode to episode. Like, you're, you know, in Context is for Kings, you're like, well, this guy's a monster.
Right.
And then you'll have an episode, you know, where he suddenly is portrayed, not even sympathetic, just like he's kind of a fun character. You know, he's kind of like goofing around or something with Burnham for a brief moment or something. And you're like, he seems pretty cool. And then an episode later, he's like sending off the Admiral to be captured by Klingons, you know? And you're like, kind of this slingshot effect where it's like, they want to kind of make him the cool captain in some ways, and then also set him up for things that are very vague.
They want to have their cake and eat it too, to a certain degree.
But it's leaving him feeling a little just indistinct. A little
underdeveloped?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's talk about Michael Burnham, of course, the main character of this series. And that I think she's been a little bit polarizing for the audience. The first two episodes, I really did dig her.
Yeah.
And we talked about it before, but she's been, and this is, I think, very much on purpose, but she's been a little bit more aloof since then. We do see her coming out of her shell ever since Magic to make the sanest man go mad. And I think that has a lot to do with her interactions with Tyler. I like Burnham. But it's not like she's like the powerhouse that was Patrick Stewart, where he has the capacity to grip you right away as the center of the series.
Right. Part of the problem with that, I think, is the fact that the previous Star Trek series were all ensemble shows, whereas Discovery is told very often from her point of view.
Yeah.
And when a story is told from a character's point of view, usually the character who's occupying that role tends to be less interesting than the ones around them.
Which is kind of a struggle, yes. Where you're like, oh, you always seem to like the funny sidekick more than the actual main character,
right.
Which is can be difficult.
Because Burnham is the avatar for the audience, taking us through this world.
Yeah.
And so if you make her a Stamets, the audience is like, well, that's kind of a little bit jarring.
So then what do you want to see from Burnham going forward? Is it just simply giving her, I don't know, letting her loosen up to a certain degree? Or what's going to be the key here?
The series was set up as sort of a redemption story for her. How do you feel the show has done 9 episodes in for sort of tracking the progress of her redemption?
I'm still kind of mystified that she was pretty much given a death sentence at end of episode 2 or lifetime hard labor.
Yeah.
With regards to, let me ask you this, does this feel like she's a character who needs to be redeemed? She's coming from a point where she did something irredeemable.
Right.
I think she did something stupid.
Sure.
So this redemption journey...
Worf has killed many a people.
I know.
Walked away scot-free, so...
So this is maybe why it's a bit of a flawed journey in that I've forgiven her. I see her as redeemed in my eyes. So is this just about Starfleet Command doing so? Because if you see her aboard the Discovery, she seems to be fitting in quite well. People like her.
Yeah.
People aren't blaming her for the death of, 800 plus souls during the Battle of the Binary Stars.
Right.
So mission accomplished by episode 9? Is that it? Like, so this is kind of...
It's been a weird journey because early on you're set up like, she's the mutineer. Like, this is who she is. And by now it feels like most of that sort of edge to this character is gone.
Yeah.
She's just, going on missions with, Saru to Avatar planets and things like that. And it doesn't feel like that level of mistrust is there anymore. I'm worried this is going to turn into like the Voyager Maquis thing, where it's like the Maquis are like, we may rebel against Starfleet. And that lasts like 3 episodes.
Yeah.
And that kind of feels like where Burnham is now. Like I feel like the first like handful of episodes, 3 or 4 episodes, were really strong as to what Burnham is going through. And I feel like kind of the back half of the 9 has been kind of forgetting kind of that those sorts of stories.
I'll say the one moment that really did work in the back half of the 9, though, is when Burnham and Tyler are in the Avatar tent hut.
Sure.
And Burnham
said, my favorite scene.
This is in CV Pack and Parabellum. And this is
Nice. You've been practicing.
I have. This is where essentially Burnham says to Tyler, look, whatever happens at the end of this war, I got to go back to prison. There's really not much of a future for us. So they are acknowledging that she doesn't have like a great outlook. But
do you feel that tension though for this character? Like
no.
When you're watching the show, are you like, man, Burnham is just one day away from being back in prison?
Only when they brought it up in that hut, the Avatar hut. So going forward, and I think the audience is kind of expecting Burnham to be in command by the end of season 1 somehow, right?
Wasn't that like a rough rumor early when the series was in development? Like, I feel like that's where it came from.
Well, remember, her name wasn't even Michael Burnham.
It was going to be number one,
and then you'd find out at the end of the season what her name was.
Yeah.
How does that even work if she's a mutineer? Would Lorca have been calling her number one all season?
I think the captain expectations came from those early rumors.
Okay.
And maybe that's where she goes, by the end of the series, but I don't think it's on the one season track, maybe like the initial rumors would have hinted.
Well, what concerns me is if it is on the one season track, I don't think it will make much sense. It'll be it'll feel very much like Chris Pine going from cadet to captain within, what, 48 hours?
Does this mean Saru's going to strangle Burnham on the bridge?
That's how she gets the command.
Yeah.
So, well, okay, we'll track Burnham, but you brought up Saru just a second ago.
Yeah.
And this is a character that I've been disappointed with.
He has been, to me, I think, the biggest failing of the series so far.
I hesitate to call it a failing in that I like the character.
Right.
I don't see anything particularly wrong with the character, but it's a character I see having so much more potential that's just gone unrealized at this point.
Right. Yeah.
What do we need from Saru going forward to make him a more fully fleshed out character that we're more invested in?
Well, I think with Saru, they have a serious issue in that they haven't hammered down what his struggle is.
This is kind of the key that always makes writers think, oh man, what did I not figure out? You have to ask what the character wants.
Yes.
Cam, what does Saru want?
Quiet?
He doesn't want to feel fear.
Tranquility?
Sure.
And the thing is, with Data, there was a very identifiable, I want to be human. You know, it's the Pinocchio story referenced right in Encounter at Farpoint. You know, with Odo, there's that, he's a changeling. He doesn't feel like he belongs. He wants to know where he came from, his origins. Saru? What does he want?
And usually I know people could say, well, it's very early on in the series, sure. But I think that should be established very early on in the series. What is the character's motivation? At least with characters with, you know, we pointed out Lorca, we're a little bit on the fence, even though we really like the character.
Yeah.
I still understand what he wants. Burnham, I understand what Burnham wants. So, but with Saru, it hasn't quite hit me yet. And when they give him like a Saru-centric episode with CV Pack and Parabellum, I was kind of bummed out. I thought Choose Your Pain was actually a far better Saru story than his standout episode.
And
apparently,
what's weird is that Saru started out really strong in his, first three or four episodes. He had scenes with Burnham that were just like fireworks. And it seemed like he just kind of fizzled out from that point forward. And, you know, you and I talked on the podcast going back and forth, like, why is Saru on Discovery? Why would this character want to be on this ship?
Well, I think conscription, or not conscription, but he was assigned.
Sure.
He's fulfilling his duty.
Shouldn't he be freaked out on this ship?
Well, that's what I would think so.
Yes.
He's on a warship under a very different kind of captain than Giorgio was, so, yeah.
He seems completely fine with Lorca.
But here's this. I don't think there's no hope for the Saru character. Mm-hmm. In fact, that's why I'm excited about seeing his journey. I think there's a lot of potential for this character that I think it's going to happen eventually.
I want him to be like Spock when he served with Pike. You know, like Saru's just laughing at flowers right now.
Sure.
But once we get different captains, only Saru blossoms into like the greatest character of all time.
But instead of flowers, we're talking about blue mist.
Yeah.
Very briefly until we move on, but Cadet Tilly, this is a character we're both enjoying. We understand what the character wants. We understand, I think the characterizations from Mary Wiseman, they've been great as well.
Yeah.
So I'm down.
Is Tilly the most fun Star Trek character we've had? The most like just unabashedly fun character.
Like kind of geeking out at the cool stuff she gets to do.
Like I think there's lots of fun characters on other series like Dax, for example.
Yeah.
But there's always a little bit more, I guess maybe restraint to the way those shows tackled quote unquote fun characters that I don't feel is affecting Tilly as much. Like I feel like a Tilly character is just like infectious.
What about Neelix?
Scrap that. My whole theory is out the window. Right. Neelix is actually the most fun character of all time.
Well, I haven't been quite that high. I know Tilly has her ardent supporters.
Yeah.
I would not refer to it as infectious, but I like her. Like, she doesn't bother me. I enjoy seeing her on screen. What I enjoy most so far is watching how much she's developed, from episode 3 to episode 9, and just thinking about the possibilities that this is a cadet. If this show goes on 5, 6, 7 years, we could be seeing Commander Tilly kicking some major ass in different situations. And this is fun seeing her at such a different stage in her life.
Yeah, oh, definitely. I'm really liking this character. She feels, like Stamets. It's very unique.
Yeah.
And I love that the show kind of rolled the dice on a character like this instead of playing it safe with characters who are maybe more traditionally Trek in the sense that they're a little bit on the blander side or a little bit stiff upper lip types, you know what I mean? Which is truer to the other series.
Yeah. Why don't we segue into stories and we can integrate maybe discussions about the Klingon characters that have been introduced as well. But I think the weakest point so far with Star Trek Discovery has been the stories, in that you and I were not very much invested in this Klingon war. We've really struggled to figure out the scale of it and the stakes, and right. we haven't felt that much tension within this overall arc, even though the stories that we're getting week to week, they actually showcase a lot with regards to the characters,
yeah.
which I have appreciated. But just as an overall story arc, what are your thoughts, Cam?
Well, it's funny in that this is the first or the most heavily serialized Star Trek series, theoretically, yet. And yet I feel like the serialized aspects of it are not that good.
Yeah.
To me, it's more the standalone stuff that's been proven far more entertaining and watchable. You know, like an episode where, you know, Harry Mudd's in a prison with them. Like, that's entertaining to me. But when you ask me, like, how do I feel about the ongoing drama involving the Klingon War, the most vaguely vaguely shown war in Star Trek history,
yeah.
like, whatever, sure. I mean, I don't really care how it ends. But what I am liking is sort of the small drama at the center of it, which is like the Laurel and Voke story.
Yeah.
To me, that I'm really invested in.
Well, let's talk about that within kind of this Klingon story.
Yeah.
I'm loving Voke, Laurel. Cole got a great send-off as
yeah.
well.
Yeah.
My one issue, and we've talked about it before, so I won't, you know, beat a dead horse here, but I really think it's to the actor's detriment if they are speaking a non-native language. I don't mind subtitles if I'm watching, like, German actors speak German or French actors speak French, but for English-speaking actors to speak a non-native, like, a made-up language, I think that kind of does affect the performance. And I think it's amazing that I've been as engaged by the performances from these actors. To me, the subtitle stuff just doesn't work for me. And
right.
it's weird because I'm not usually the kind of person that would complain about such a thing. But I think that's kind of something that probably sounded cool at the time.
Yeah.
And I don't think it was really necessary for this series, though.
Right. I mean, it hasn't bothered me at all. Actually really did not get... It didn't faze me at all.
But...
And I think part of it for me was
what do you think of the actors' performances,
I've
though?
Really liked all three of the Klingon actors.
Yeah.
Mary Chifo, Kenneth Mitchell, and .. as your Klingon characters. I felt like even though they're speaking gibberish, ultimately, the characters came through, and that's what I cared about. Like, I felt
yeah.
who the character of Laurel was, regardless of what language she was speaking on screen.
But to me, like, my favorite Laurel scenes are when she's with Admiral Cornwall, and they're talking
right.
to each other in English.
Right.
So, you know, or what about Cole's send-off, where they had the universal translator going on between him and Burnham? And,
sure.
you know, the actor, I think, is able to do so much more speaking in a native language versus a made-up language.
To be fair, though, Cole had nothing really that interesting to do in the previous episode.
I know, but I was using that as, like, the perfect, like, ha-ha, got you there, Cam.
You thought you could get me, because you know what? Picking your teeth with a badge works in any language, as far
okay.
as I'm concerned.
What do you want to see from the story of Discovery going forward? We left it on a cliffhanger where
yeah.
they say that, yeah, the Klingon War is not over yet, but we can probably use this technology
yeah.
to wind things up.
Sure.
And then we disappear to some unknown...
Yeah, so we have 6 episodes left. We're in another dimension. I mean, how much does the Klingon War really even matter at this point?
I don't think it does, and it makes me wonder why they wanted to devote season 1 to this.
I mean, I wonder if the Klingon War idea came from the initial whatever Brian Fuller had in mind, and it kind of stuck around.
It certainly did.
Yeah, and it's like, well, we'll stick with that, but we want to do different things, and it's kind of like we got the watered-down version of it.
Yeah.
That's what it feels like, because the Klingon War is not going to go down in history as one of the great Star Trek arcs.
It's definitely not there with the Dominion War invasion arc, you know,
no.
where... So I hope what we get when we return is, I think this is a...
Here's my question to you. Do you want to see them, you know, continue with the Klingon War arc? Or would you just prefer that we had more kind of different types of episodes like magic to make the sanest man go mad?
I don't think the Klingon War arc has been successful.
Can it be salvaged?
Can it be salvaged? Yeah,
okay.
I think it can.
Yeah.
But what I'd much prefer is, like you said, magic. Like those kind of, we need more of those kind of episodic one-off episodes that are actually carrying on the overall story arcs or character arcs,
yeah.
I should say. And if there are serialized story elements within that, I'm fine. But I don't think we need, I think a war is a very high stakes thing. And we at least got to build to that with 2 seasons of Enterprise before we had the Zindi War arc.
Right.
And we got to build to that with five seasons of DS9 before the Dominion War.
Yeah.
With we got two episodes with Discovery, and it just has
half that crew, or more than half that crew, didn't show up again.
Exactly. And, and to me, I think it can be salvaged, but not on the path that they're going right now, where it wasn't until CB Pack and Parabellum that we actually, it actually felt tense when they had that opening teaser showing off that battle sequence, which I thought was really great. And I was like, oh, I finally feel that there's stakes here, but so far, no good.
I don't know. When I compare like the sort of war and space combat aspects of Discovery to an episode like Balance of Terror from the original series, I'm just like, this is not even in the same ballpark.
I know.
And I know that at least Brian Fuller had said Balance of Terror was a real touchstone for what they wanted to do with season one of Discovery. I mean, it's not really working.
No. And which is funny because we both... Okay, we're doing a mid-season report card of Discovery. I think we should both just say this. Like, what do we think so far of Star Trek Discovery?
Yeah, like, I'm actually really... as negative as I sound on a lot of the sort of the arc-based stuff, I'm really enjoying this show. The characters are a lot of fun. And there are episodes that... I think have been fantastic. Like, I really loved Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad. I thought the Into the Forest I Go, for whatever, the first before the mid-season break, was great. Like, I think this show is capable of greatness. I hope they're learning lessons that will inform season two.
Yeah.
Like, I know they talked about how season two would be kind of about the after effects of the Klingon War. And I hope they mean that in a loose term, as in, like, this is not, like... about rebuilding the Klingon Empire or whatever. It's about just characters kind of getting over that war and moving forward and not having this really this season-long arc tied to a very specific event.
I was going to say exactly is I don't need season two to be an ongoing arc covering one single storyline like we're getting so far with the Klingon stuff.
Yeah, like let's follow what the characters are doing for a season and have them going through, you know, relationships or changes or anything like that. But I don't need a big defining, like it feels like they want it to be sold as like season one is the Klingon War. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like it's kind of like you'd say, as you said, you know, season three of Enterprise, the Zindi War arc. And it feels like they want, that was maybe what they had in mind when they started the series. But I don't think that's a path that's you really got to pull it off. If you don't, it kind of drags down a season.
Yeah. Cam, let's touch on this briefly, and then we're going to get into the fun part of the episode. But world building, we talked about the Klingons, the aliens that have been introduced so far. What about the other aliens that we've gotten to meet? There really haven't been that many, though.
No.
We've seen, like, the space whale, the tardigrade.
Those cool-looking things from the Vulcan Hello, the desert planet.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So far, I'm liking who we've met, but with this war arc, it's not so much exploring strange new worlds at this point. And we did get to see one strange new world, and you and I weren't...
Pandora.
We weren't big fans of the Pandora ripoff episode, but I think we both like the aesthetics of of how the planet was depicted, no matter whether it was a homage or a ripoff of Pandora.
Right,
but
right. I mean, yeah, but I would say that I'm hoping that's not like a high point of the series when it comes to alien depictions.
Well, I mean, look, if they keep trying to outdo themselves, then I'm down for it. But honestly, this is like Star Trek, if you look at all their other depictions of alien planets, what's really...
Sure.
You know,
usually pretty boring.
Yeah, so I think this is actually kind of a high point so far for Star Trek.
Yeah.
I mean, what's its competition?
Maybe it's just like I'm more charmed by, like, especially the original series, where they really just like swung away at the fences for like crazy alien designs and making, even though it's all on the same soundstage, making those worlds feel really weird in an interesting way. Whereas like some of the other series weren't as good at that. You know, it was just very generic.
Yeah.
But I would like to see Discovery, you know, the Avatar planet was fine, but I'd like to see them really swing away at making these worlds feel very distinct from one another and doing crazy things, like just go nuts, because that's the fun stuff. That's the thing, you know, fans remember. People don't talk about, like, you know, the random bumpy-headed alien planet, you know, from, you know, episode whatever from TNG, you know. It's like they like the ones that stand out.
Yeah.
So I'd
don't
like
make
to see
it boring.
More.
That's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah. And I hope season two is bigger on discovering alien civilizations or what have you.
I think that might be one of... I'm wondering if the response that they get from Magic could inform a lot of how they take on season two, because I think most fans would say that Magic is probably the highlight of the series so far.
Do you think they knew that it would be such a big deal? Because often you hear about, you know, film studios or what have you, like, not knowing what they had.
No, I don't think so, because I remember we were at the convention, and Akiva Goldsman was talking about how amazed and blown away he was by CV Pack and Parabellum. This is before we got the episode title.
Right.
And you and I both, I think we kind of think this is kind of the low point of the first nine episodes, right?
Well, I kind of teased that last week, and that, you know, every week I get to see, you know, how many hits, you know, the blog posts have gotten, that sort of thing. Yeah. And Magic to Make the Sanest Man Go Mad, I believe, was the highest. Okay. It was up there with Into the Forest I Go for the highest number of hits. The lowest by a huge, huge margin was CV Packham, Parabellum. Like, it wasn't even in the ballpark as the other episodes, any of the other episodes.
The only bit of defense I'll give is, oh, no, wait. No, I got nothing.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Like, it just shows to me that, like, maybe fans don't hate that episode, but no one was interested in hearing more about it.
Really. To me, it wasn't like I've seen bad episodes of Star Trek.
We're going to talk about some in a little bit.
Yeah, this was not a bad episode. It was just you and I were kind of not nearly as invested in it as we were in all the other ones that we had seen. So,
which is a bummer considering it was a character building episode for Saru.
I know. Okay. Cam, why don't we jump into the fun part? Because look, we've taken Star Trek Discovery episodes 1 through 9 as a whole. Why don't we go through that with every single series and see if it's been a bit of a rough ride early on, maybe a rougher ride for some other certain series versus Discovery. So this will be fun. Cam, why don't we just start with the original series? We'll go in...
my beloved original series.
Chronological order. And why don't I just read them off here. The Man Trap, Charlie X, Where No Man Has Gone Before, The Naked Time, The Enemy Within, Mud's Women, What Are Little Girls Made Of, Miri, Dagger of the Mind. So those are the first nine episodes that viewers ever got to see with regards to Star Trek, period.
And a fun little side note, Corbomite Maneuver was the first episode shot for the series and was held back because the effects were so expensive. So that, you know, you can almost technically even say that.
But
in terms of airing, for sure. But it means that out of the gate, they really did know how to hammer down that series, I think, with episode one right from, even though they aired it later.
The reason why I'm poking at those is because then you could make the argument for The Cage as well, because that was shot.
Also great.
That's why we're only going to stick with the first nine
to
air.
Talk about the nine.
And so that we can compare it with the first nine of Discovery to air. Overall, how do you think these stack up versus what Discovery's delivered when it comes to first nine? Are there more highs and more lows, or is it more kind of a consistent kind of delivery of what we've gotten?
Well, I mean, anyone who listens to this show knows that I am a huge original series fan. It's my favorite series. I would actually say the first nine episodes of the original series are pretty middle of the road episodes. I think you get Naked Time is fantastic. I think that's probably their best early episode, but you can see when you're looking at an episode like, you know, The Enemy Within or Dagger of the Mind, they're not bad. Enemy Within,
the Enemy
great,
Within
that's
is...
that's a bad choice, actually. I shouldn't say that one.
Okay.
I'll say What Little Girls Are Made Of and Dagger of the Mind.
You know, I was going to bring up Dagger of the Mind. Like, that's one that I really did like.
I like it, but I don't think it's a great episode, and you could see how they would improve upon it later.
Yeah. I think one of the lamer ones, though, Charlie X, and that's...
You think that's one of the lamer ones? I don't know. To me, that episode is so hilarious and fun that I kind of love it.
Was it meant to be hilarious? Like...
Well, do you think when they're shooting, like, Kirk, like, stripping down and oiling himself up to wrestle Charlie X, they were like, this is serious television?
I think they're like, this is what a man looks like. This is what it means to be...
Well, I agree.
Yeah. No, but he's trying to teach Charlie what it's like to be a man. I think that they were very earnest in what they were trying to do there. I can sit back and laugh my ass off at Charlie X.
Yeah.
It's never going to end up on any top 20, top 30 list of mine that I ever make for the original series. So
I'm kind of an apologist for Charlie X just because it's so weird.
Okay.
It's so strange.
Well, I'll say this. Charlie X, I've got no problem if somebody said, hey, let's go watch Charlie X. But if somebody's like, yeah, you want to watch Miri again? I'd be like, please no.
Yeah, because I would say Miri is actually a good comparison point for CV Pacem Parabellum in that I don't think Miri is a like horrific hour of television. I don't think it's like anywhere. It's not like the alternative factor from later in the season one. To me, it's just an episode that they have kind of an okay idea for an episode, and it just feels pained when it's stretched out. that's kind of, you know, for me, how Miri feels.
Well, you know, Cam, you should choose your pain.
You should.
What, another parallel?
Yeah, Harry Mudd.
Harry Mudd, yes. So what do we think of the introduction of Harry Mudd early on in Discovery versus the introduction early on of Harry Mudd in the original series? I know where I come down.
Yeah, I know where you come down to. I will say this. When I saw Mudd's Women, I actually really liked the character of Harry Mudd in the early chapters. I mean, Act 1. When they're introducing this rascally character onto the ship, you're like, this is fun. I haven't seen this, you know, because the crew is kind of very stoic and by the book. And to see a character like that thrown in is a fun idea. The actual episode itself about, yeah, taking the women to the mining colony, it's just boring. Like, I don't think there's a lot of dramatic interest in it. I don't think it's funny. It's kind of comedy that hasn't aged well. So for an audience now, I'm curious.
Sex trafficking comedy hasn't aged well, Cam?
It may make a comeback. Who knows?
Okay.
But this seems like the good time in Hollywood for that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, no kidding.
But yeah.
Wait, you're making jokes out of it right now.
I know. But no, it just feels like an episode that doesn't really have any sort of... It's time has passed.
Well, to me, you know, people already know, listeners know that I just kind of find that episode offensive. But also, like you said, the further on you get into the episode, it gets kind of boring.
Yeah. Like, how do you feel, though, in Act 1 about the introduction of Harry Mudd?
Yeah, fine. Rascally rogue. And I think that's what they were going for with Discovery.
Yeah.
As much as I had a problem with reintroducing Harry Mudd to the franchise in Discovery, I actually really like what Rainn Wilson's doing here.
And I think he had two fantastic introductions in both episodes.
I wasn't sold on him in Choose Your Pain.
But I mean how the character's introduced in that moment.
Okay.
You know, like his first scene in the episode.
Well, okay, but talking about introductions, if we're going to magic, when he takes off the helmet, the Andorian helmet, and that's pretty dang awesome.
Oh, it's incredible. Like I love what they've actually done with Harry Mudd, and that while we can go back and forth about whether it was a good idea to use this character, I like the idea of taking a character that is in many ways unsalvageable and doing everything they can to try and salvage him. Like, it's an interesting idea, whether the character deserves it or not. I'm always interested when, even outside of Star Trek, you know, you'll see, like, you know, a comic book character who's a joke for years and decades or whatever is suddenly, like, tackled by a writer who just feels passionate about this character for some reason and turns them into something interesting.
Yeah.
And I always think that's kind of cool.
One last episode I want to highlight, just because it's the first episode, The Man Trap. How does that stack up versus the Vulcan Hello?
Well, it's... ambitions are much smaller.
Mm-hmm.
The Man Trap is an episode that I think the most you really get out of it is the salt vampire.
Yeah.
I don't think it's an episode that's particularly interesting. It's fine. It's fun.
Yeah. How do you think the Vulcan Hello stands up as an introduction to a series, like an episode one?
Yeah. The problem with Vulcan Hello, as you say, as an introduction to a series, is that it's not really
representative of what the series
is. Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
So is that really context is for Kings?
Yeah. Okay. It kind of is.
It's tough. I'm just saying, like, when we watched that first hour,
yeah,
forget about Battle of the Binary Stars. When we watched that first hour, it actually relieved me a lot of the anxieties that maybe I had going forward about this series, and that, like, I really did like the characters. I liked kind of the universe that they were establishing. So as far as world building, it did work for me at that point.
And I think both the original series and Discovery nailed their visual aesthetic right out of the gate really well.
Yeah.
I think that's important.
Okay.
Because it's always kind of awkward when you're watching them kind of bumble around for the first handful of episodes, and things just don't look right when you revisit the episodes.
Like the first couple episodes of Seinfeld, where it's like the apartment's all different, and Kramer has a different first name.
Kessler.
Yeah. It's like, so Kim, why don't we mosey on over to Star Trek: The Next Generation, and I'll just read them off here. Encounter at Farpoint, The Naked Now, Code of Honor, The Last Outpost, Where No One Has Gone Before, Lonely Among Us, Justice, and The Battle.
Which... people often speak about how bad the first couple seasons of Next Generation are.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually kind of remarkable how memorable a lot of these nine are.
A lot of these stinkers are?
They may be bad, but they're bad in interesting ways, at least, where, like, we remember them.
Well, let's say this, like, Code of Honor is legendary.
Yes.
In how racist and offensive it is.
And Justice is legendary for being completely off-the-wall batshit.
So it, we also have kind of the introduction of very important aliens, like The Last Outpost gives us the Ferengi.
Yeah, not and, well, but yeah.
Yeah, Encounter at Farpoint gives us Q, one of the most significant antagonists Star Trek's ever had.
Yeah.
So I okay, as much as people would, I think, argue correctly that early Next Gen seasons were pretty weak, I think it's still intriguing how much world building went on that it still resonates with a lot of fans.
Well, did TNG know its world fairly well, do you think, when it began? Maybe it would make course corrections, like with the Ferengi as your main antagonist, but did it understand its world?
I think that's a good question. Okay, so on the basic levels, yes, but there's moments where I'm watching early TNG, and it just doesn't feel as if the universe or the world is quite as fleshed out as it becomes later, where we're right. encountering the Klingons or the Romulans every three or four episodes, and where it seems as if it's a little bit of a smaller universe, so to speak, later right. on, which I think informs a lot of the world building early on in Next Gen. It seemed like they were out in the far reaches of space.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that quite answers your question, but there is definitely...
No, not at all. I'm very angry.
But I know what you're saying with kind of the world building versus the course correcting. I think they understood it to a certain degree, but there were a number of course corrections that I think made sense for the progress of the series.
You could also see in those first nine how the show maybe understood its world, but it was still not sure of like how to dramatically represent TNG on screen, because you can see a lot of echoes to the original series, even though they weren't allowed to acknowledge some of those characters by name. You watch episodes like The Naked Now, Elements of Encounter at Farpoint, Code of Honor. These feel like TNG episodes, TOS episodes. In some cases, bad TOS episodes, but TOS episodes nonetheless.
So would that be frightening for a lot of viewers of Star Trek Discovery if we just saw that the first nine episodes, it seemed as if they were trying to copy
what came before? Yeah, and do you think Discovery has been brave in not doing that?
Because that's
been what it's been most controversial for.
But I'll say this. I think maybe Discovery, one of the faults, though, is maybe it holds the ideals of the franchise with too much reverence, in which a lot of times I just feel as if we're saying we have a very special message, and this is how it aligns with Star Trek ideals. And right. we just want to make sure you're aware that we're aware of it. And right. I'm just like, you know what? Just be your own thing and just revel in it, to a certain degree. This is why Next Gen, I think, eventually worked, is because it wasn't trying to be TOS. And the reason why DS9 worked is because it wasn't trying to be TNG. And I think Discovery, I don't think it's trying to be any particular series, but I think it's too reverential to the franchise.
Of the first nine, which episode do you think represents the best of sort of the vision of TNG? Because it's a tough batch, that first nine.
The vision of TNG.
Yeah.
Honestly, you're going to like smack me upside the head, but maybe Where No One Has Gone Before.
It might be.
You know, for those who don't remember, that's where the Traveler first appears. So
I would say maybe Elements of Encounter at Farpoint.
Yeah, Elements. Yeah,
Elements. Like, I don't think the actual Farpoint story does, but I guess the Q stuff does.
Yeah. Okay.
But no, it is a weird batch of episodes in that they feel a lot of the times very TOS-ish, but the characters are close. You know, there's a little bit of off-model stuff with Picard and Worf, but they aren't.
They feel fairly
consistent.
Do you know what it is? It feels like they're doing TOS karaoke.
Yeah.
You know, where you got a different cast trying to emulate the big hits of the day. But you know what? It only gets good when they start doing their own originals.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I got that one. Yeah, so, Cam, why don't we mosey on over to Deep Space Nine here. This is a fascinating examination or number of episodes that we get to go through here, but I'll read them out once again. Emissary, Past Prologue, A Man Alone, Babel, Captive Pursuit, Q-less, Dax, The Passenger.
Yeah.
Are any of these good episodes, Cam?
Yeah, I think Captive Pursuit's a really good episode.
Well, that's, for those who don't remember, Tosk, the alien that Chief O'Brien befriends. And if you've ever been to a Star Trek convention, they've got about 1,400 Tosk toys that they're trying to give away.
Yeah.
So I thought that was an okay episode.
I really like that episode a lot. I think that's actually
really?
I think that might be the first like really good episode of DS9.
Really good.
Yeah, I didn't say great. I said really good.
Okay.
Because to me that's the first one that feels like it really gets into the characters and what makes them a little bit different than TNG, and I think it's a really good O'Brien episode.
It's an episode I've seen twice and I've never felt compelled to watch it thrice. Okay. So, but
I think Babel is a fun episode, but it actually does also feel very like TNG-ish or TOS-ish.
Well, Marina Sirtis has complained that in those seasons of DS9 and TNG when they're on consecutively, they were just stealing like good TNG scripts and giving them to the DS9 actors. I'm a little bit skeptical of that claim from Marina Sirtis.
Yeah,
you know, but
when you look at the first season of DS9,
I'm just like, where were the good scripts?
Yeah, but there are some real like just crap piles in that season.
Yeah,
like, A Man Alone and The Passenger are awful. Awful episodes.
I remember being bored to death out of those ones. I think Dax was one. I actually remember watching First Run.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, I think I'll keep watching TNG.
Yeah, it's not a very good episode, even though... Is it the only episode named after a character on the show?
I think so. I'm trying to rack my brain for anything.
I'm even going across the franchise. You've got Sarek. That's a guest star, though. Yeah. Like, in terms of actual...
Miri.
In terms of leads on your show, is that the only one?
Yeah, there wasn't an episode called Picard. You had
Spock's brain. I guess that counts.
That counts. Okay. I was going to say A Briefing with Neelix, but that's not the actual name of an episode.
No, that's just what we like to think it's called.
That's a reference to Investigations.
Yeah.
Another arc that didn't really pan out the way I think the writers were hoping.
Yeah.
So anyway. No,
but it's... DS9 is such a fantastic series, and you know the showrunners of Discovery have talked about how DS9 was a huge influence to them, but I don't think the first 9 episodes are representative of what that show is.
When did DS9 start to get a better handle? I know everybody points to, say, season 3 when the Defiant comes on, or season 4 when Worf enters the series, but if you look at season 1, there's probably only one superb episode.
Duet. Yeah.
You know, and then it's kind of inconsistent. Do you think they start getting a better handle just right from out of the gate of season 2 with the 3-episode arc there, all about Bajoran politics?
Or here's the question. Did they have it figured out right off the get-go with Emissary, but then they just kind of wound up going straight into kind of sub-TNG type episodes?
Maybe.
Like, had they followed the breadcrumbs of Emissary straight into season 1 in over several episodes, maybe they would have been more on the right path?
Well, I think Emissary's, like, out of the batch I've just gone out over here, I like it more than Captive Pursuit. I think that's actually the strongest one. And I think when you rewatched it semi-recently, you actually said, it's actually much better than I remembered it being.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I agree with you with regards to the breadcrumbs. It would have been better. And I think that's kind of the problem with maybe series is if they're just trying to copy what has gone on before them.
And then you have an episode like Q-less, which is the Q episode, which we talk about in our Evolution of Q episode. It's worth listening to. That's just a garbage episode.
Yeah.
But, you know, like an episode like Past Prologue, not great, but it is, you know, you get to see Garak pop up on the series and suddenly that adds a lot of intrigue. It's just like more than any of their series, DS9 feels like it's really finding the ingredients throughout its first 2 seasons and really bringing them together. Whereas, like, I don't feel like TNG, the first 2 seasons, was really them bringing elements together. It's more like when they got to season 3, they're like, we got to kind of shift this show as to what it is.
You asked me about kind of the world building early on in TNG and if that represented what we got later on, and I think there were some changes that had to be made, but with DS9, I think it was a very fleshed out world that was right there, and they just continued to add to it. It wasn't like there was some drastic, you know, big thematic change or anything like that.
Yeah.
I mean, we would touch on different themes.
Keiko O'Brien got a school.
Oh, yes. And then she lost it.
Was that season 1 as well?
Yeah, I think it blew up in the Hands of the Prophets.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah.
Yeah. Poor Keiko.
Yeah, well.
Yeah. Why don't we head on over to Voyager, starting with Caretaker, Parallax, Time and Again, Phage, The Cloud, Eye of the Needle, Ex Post Facto, and Emanations.
What a memorable batch of episodes.
I would say that there's actually two pretty good ones, though. I would say Phage and Eye of the Needle.
Yeah. Actually, and I'll even say Caretaker.
Caretaker's actually a good, solid introduction to the universe here.
To be fair, too, I actually rewatched the episode Parallax for this episode, and actually, I really like that episode, too.
There's a lot of good Harry Kim B'Elanna stuff going on that I liked.
Yeah. In Parallax, you have the central
Starfleet.
The central, like, you know, sci-fi aspect of it is not interesting. It's just like a Mirror Voyager and a Braga episode, isn't it? Yeah, it might be. Yeah, and an Event Horizon. Like, it's just not that interesting. But the episode is really about B'Elanna being promoted to chief engineer and sort of the drama that goes along with it. And you have a lot of squabbling between Janeway and Chakotay, where I was like, whoa, this is what that show was should have been like.
Yeah.
And, you know, even characters like Tuvok feel like they're actually could be interesting, which is completely deflated.
Well, it's very early on in the run of the series, so it's kind of like we have to give everybody something to do.
Yeah.
And then I think, like you said, like the air comes out of the balloon eventually with regards to what we get week to week on Star Trek,
like,
Voyager.
Parallax feels like almost like a second pilot. Yeah. It's establishing the characters even more so. But yeah, once you kind of get into these like strings of like, well, I kind of feel like TNG ripoff episodes, like early DS9. The one that really jumps out to me, though, is Ex Post Facto, which is the one where Tom is accused of murder for, like, having an affair with that man's wife.
Yeah.
What the hell was that?
That's a Riker, Riker kind of episode, isn't it?
That might be one of the worst Voyager episodes.
One of the worst?
I don't remember.
I do remember watching it and think it is stupid, but not one of the worst. But
it's really awful.
Right. But let's talk about Phage and Eye of the Needle, and that I think what they're doing is taking like high concept ideas, executing them in pretty cool ways, and actually giving the characters interesting things to do. And I think, I don't know, I'm higher on those two episodes than what we got out of the first nine of DS9 or TNG, for example.
And the Phage, you know, you see the Vidians come into play, and actually I think, as much as, you know, we were ridiculing Neelix earlier, I think Neelix is never maybe more interesting than season one of Voyager.
Where it he's seems like whining they're about his lungs.
But it seems like they're interested in like giving that character some gravitas, which is completely gone after season one.
Because at least we do get episodes like Jatrell.
Yeah, later on, yeah.
So, yeah, there's that.
And but I think the Phage actually plays up sort of the trauma that goes with his injury and like how fearful he is. Like, that character would not be played that seriously for quite a few seasons to come.
Yeah. If we take those first nine episodes of Voyager from a whole, though, let's think about it from the world-building perspective, because I think an episode like the Phage, they actually establish a pretty frightening alien species, and I wish we got to see more of the Deans. And then with Eye of the Needle, you kind of get the sense that, you know, are we going to get an easy way home?
Right.
The answer is no. It's like they're going to make this difficult, even though they're talking about the Harry Kim wormhole that they're going to name after him. But
right. Well, I think that one thing that's done really well in the first handful of Voyager episodes is the idea of how these characters are going to have to push up against the Prime Directive and everything Starfleet stands for to get home. I think that's something they actually did a really good job with. And Kate Mulgrew, I think, is fantastic, and especially this first handful. And the show would really lose that. Like, you know, I think the show starts off in many ways more confidently than like Deep Space Nine or TNG. And yet it maybe suffers the most kind of falling apart over the course of its seven seasons.
I would use the word complacency.
Yeah, you know, that's a good word.
They're like, hey, here's our groove. This is what we like to do. This is what we don't like to do. And it's a show that felt more complacent to me than any of the other Star Trek series.
Like, I feel like this should have been a show with a lot of desperation to it, because these characters are pushed to the brink in a way that none of the other series really are. And it never feels like it. In fact, if anything, it feels like they're having the most fun of any of the crews.
Yeah,
you get to the later seasons, they're hanging out in like the beach holodeck program and stuff like that.
Well, Cam, the holodeck uses a different type of power than the rest of the
course.
Ship. That's why
of
they
course.
Are, yeah.
It just seems like they're having a really goofy time a lot.
Yeah.
A lot.
Well, speaking of goofy times and water polo, why don't we mosey on over to Star Trek Enterprise, or as it was known when it first premiered, Cam, Enterprise.
Right.
Yeah. So, Broken Bow, Fight or Flight, Strange New World, Unexpected, Terra Nova, The Andorian Incident, Breaking the Ice, Civilization. Do you think this could be the weakest batch of episodes early on, in that at least with DS9, you could point to some highlights. Same with TNG, elements of, say, Encounter at Farpoint, perhaps. What do you really point to with these first few episodes of Enterprise? I think there's one element, maybe one particular character, but I don't know about you.
Yeah, I feel like Enterprise has a very strong premiere, and I look forward to revisiting it for the podcast later down the
road. I remember liking Broken Bow.
Yeah, like I felt like it was a pretty fantastic premiere. But yeah, when you look at those episodes, you know, presented on paper as I am now, they are not a compelling bunch of episodes, and frankly, not particularly memorable. You know, you can look at an episode like the Andorian incident and be like, well, that's the one where Sharan first comes in. But it's not a very interesting or dramatically gripping episode.
You and I watched it not too long ago for our Andorian episode.
Yeah.
And it was kind of a slog. It was just like watching a hostage situation, and we've seen that a million times before, especially in Star Trek.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
Yeah. And you would see like an episode like Fight or Flight, like it's interesting to kind of see the Hoshi story in that we would never see another Hoshi story again. But I mean, a lot of these episodes feel like warmed over like TNG episodes, which I know at the time was very controversial with fans because this was the prequel series. This was taking us theoretically into TOS. And yet, why are we watching episodes that feel like they came from Voyager?
Well, Cam, why don't I show you a bit of a clip here that I think exemplifies kind of the issue that Enterprise was having finding its identity. So this is a clip from Civilization. This is actually the marketing that they used for this episode. And they're trying to get people to watch Star Trek Enterprise, or Enterprise, right, as is known back in the day.
It began as a mission of mercy.
People are dying and I can't determine why.
Tell us what you know. We might be able to help.
But became something more personal.
There are lots of inhabited planets to see, but I doubt many will be this memorable.
An all-new Enterprise.
What the hell was that?
That song was not even cool back in 2002, 2003 when this episode aired, Cam.
What is that song called again?
I don't know.
I know the song.
Like, it's Creed.
No, it isn't.
No, it's not Creed.
It's that one where, okay, I remember the video shows, it starts with like a kid who looks really young, and then he opens his mouth and he sounds like a 50-year-old man. And I remember my friend Mark and I just like laughing our heads off at that video.
Mark, previous podcast guest.
Yeah, yeah, on Star Trek V, The Final Frontier.
Yeah.
Was it The Calling?
I think that sounds familiar.
I think it might be The Calling.
Okay.
Whatever. But it's a bad song. Total. But
what are they, like, to me, okay, this just exemplifies part of the issue with Enterprise and just how it was supposed to be like not your daddy's Star Trek, and we're getting lame ass music like this.
Well, it's very similar to the opening theme song, really. But I mean,
is this kind of music that Rick Berman thought was cool?
Well, they said they wanted U2's A Beautiful Day as their opening credit song. So that tells you the level of edginess they were aiming for, and that's music my parents would happily listen to.
Guitar player?
That's a good point. Yeah,
do you think they could have afforded the royalty fees for U2's A Beautiful Day?
You have to pay them every week, don't you?
Yeah.
Oof, no way, no way.
That'd be what, like $70,000 a week from the budget?
I will say, to be fair to this terrible teaser for this episode, the episode Civilization is not a good episode, and frankly, I don't know how I would market that one either to anyone, especially Enterprise was pitched as like a series to bring in new fans. I remember Entertainment Weekly doing cover stories and really saying like, this isn't like the other Star Trek shows. You should be watching this, people who maybe were intimidated by the idea of jumping on a show like Voyager, which feels like it's coming, you know, after two previous series. I don't see how this trailer, though, would convince anyone that this is a must-see episode. But to be fair, it isn't.
And I was a hardcore Star Trek fan. I was tuning in every week, but my issue was, as much as I saw, I was excited by Voyager.
Yeah.
Deep Space Nine was one I came around to, but with Enterprise, I was in that kind of oversaturation period.
Yeah.
And they weren't giving me enough compelling reasons to tune in week to week, especially when we're getting episodes like Civilization, which I remember just being like, yawn. And even the Andorian incident, which introduces Shran, it's still like, yawn. And
there's not even episodes in there like so bad that they're like iconic. I mean, I guess you could make the argument that Unexpected is that for many fans. Yeah. But I don't know. Like, it's not one like I watch like Code of Honor where I'm just like smacking my head like, oh my God, what were they thinking? It's more like I can totally understand how that episode got through. Well,
it's incredibly tone deaf.
Yeah, sure. Like it's a bad comedy episode, and I've seen those in lots of other shows. It's, you know, a premise that's not working well. It just doesn't really work. And well, they're just kind of stretching
it. A fundamentally flawed premise in that Trip is sexually assaulted and it's played for laughs because guess what? A man's pregnant.
Well, sense of humor was different back in 2004, I guess. Or, no, was it, what year was that?
I think it was 2002.
2002, yeah. Yeah, I mean, the world was a different place in 2002, but...
Sure. Pre-Harvey Weinstein.
That's right. Pre a lot of things. Yeah. But, I mean, it's not... I don't know. It's just such a flat first nine, which... I would be very curious to know because I know that there was a lot of fanfare put into the premiere, into getting people to watch that premiere. And I would be curious to know how many people stuck with the series through this, you know, 9 hours of TV after. Like,
not enough to get it a season five, Cam.
Yeah, like, I don't have the numbers for me. I would just love to know if there was, like, significant drop-offs week to week because... It does seem like this batch would break a novice viewer.
Yeah.
Like, what do they? What would keep them coming back?
So, Cam, as we wrap up this, how do you think Discovery then stacks up its first nine episodes versus the rest of Star Trek?
I think Discovery is looking really good. I think Discovery may have the most confident front nine. Do you think?
I would say it's the most consistent.
Does it have the highest highs? Of a
you know,
first nine hours.
I really dig Magic. You know, I thought that was like the strongest out of the 54 episodes we've talked about so far this evening. I think that was the strongest episode there, and it felt Star Trek in a way that I was complaining about. Maybe it feels over reverential towards it. I think this is just Star Trek because it was Star Trek. You know,
I mean, when we reviewed Into the Forest, I go. I made a lot of comparisons between that episode and Zero Hour, the wrap-up to the Zindi War arc. Zero Hour is like one of the big highlights of that arc. And we're talking about the first nine episodes of Discovery saying this is equal to one of the highlights of Season 3 Enterprise, which is a great season.
I'm happy to make the argument that the Discovery introductory episodes are the strongest introductory episodes that we've had from a franchise.
And I even think a lot of the sort of groundling episodes like Context is for Kings or The Butcher's Knife. Okay, what is it? The Butcher's Knife Cares Not for the Lamb's Cry.
You got it, yeah.
Yeah, like I really like these episodes and I think they establish the characters well in, you know, sort of the ways that actually early Voyager episodes did. But I think Discovery has been a little more consistent. Like you don't have some of the lows like the cloud.
There's coffee in that nebula.
If anything, you can accuse, you know, CV Pacum Parabellum of being like, you know, a Terra Nova or a civilization, where it's just like one of those forgettable episodes that you're just like, ah, whatever. But the rest of them are pretty memorable so far.
Yeah.
Like, you know, when we were sitting to do research for this episode, like, there was quite a few of these I'd frankly forgotten, especially from Enterprise and Voyager.
That's why I was looking up trailers for some episodes just to jog my memory, and that's how I came across that awful Civilization trailer.
I gotta be honest, I could not remember Lonely Among Us from TNG.
You know, as soon as I watched the trailer for that one as well, I was like, oh yeah, the Cobra Head guys.
Right.
Like, yeah, that one.
But I don't... it would be curious to know a few years down the road how vague some of the Discovery episodes are to me.
For me, I think it's going to be Butcher.
Really? That's the one?
Yeah, because I had to think about it for a second where I was like, oh yeah, the mining colony. The mining colony must be saved.
I think that episode is hurt a little bit in the sense that it does feel like a part two to Context is for Kings. It wraps up sort of a lot of the story elements of that episode, as opposed to kind of standing on its own with new things.
Okay. But to me, I think that's just serialized storytelling.
It is. But it prevents that episode from maybe popping out as an individual episode as much as maybe it deserves.
Okay. Well, Cam, why don't we head on over to the Ortonville report?
Yeah.
It's going to be the last report of 2017.
Everyone's crying real tears right now.
So, Cam, the Orville just wrapped its first season with episode 12 out of 13 that were produced.
Right.
So I guess technically...
The learning curve of the season.
Yeah, I will be back, I suppose, for episode one of season two. But after that, I don't think you guys will be able to look forward to...
Will it be back next September?
I would assume so.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. They haven't announced like an official date, but so the season finale, though, written by Brandon Braga, directed by Seth MacFarlane. This is Mad Idolatry. So, or I should reverse that. It was directed by Brandon Braga, written by Seth MacFarlane, because Seth MacFarlane has written, I think, like 9 or 10 out of 12 episodes.
Right.
So essentially, you like the episode Who Watches the Watchers?
Yeah.
You know I do.
Yeah, it's a really strong season 3 TNG episode.
You know the Voyager episode, Blink of an Eye?
Yes, that's a really great episode. Yeah. That's one of the best of Voyager's run.
So what if you took two fantastic episodes, two of the best episodes, in my opinion, of Star Trek, and turned it into the Orville?
I don't know. What does happen?
I don't know. It was fine. It was just derivative. But I'm just like, you're taking gold here, and you better be confident that you can rise above what had come before or do something really new and original.
Right.
And with this, it just seemed like derivative.
What's the rough premise of the episode?
I just spelled it out there. Okay. They land on a planet appears in front of them.
Yeah.
And Kelly, the first officer, encounters a woman or a girl who hit her head on a rock and uses like a laser suture to heal her. Then they get off the planet, it disappears and reappears a few days later, and it's 700 years in the future, and now they're all worshiping the Kelly. And she goes and explains, don't worship me, I'm not a god, and she shows how her technology works, very much like Who Watches the Watchers.
Yeah.
And Isaac, the robot, ends up going back onto the planet, much like the Doctor did in Blink of an Eye.
Does he have a child?
No, he does not. Oh, okay. But he hangs out on the planet for about 700 years, and we don't get to see that very much.
That really
like the
is like Blink of an Eye.
Yeah. So there you go. So I, as much as I'm kind of being dismissive of the story, is actually the one thing I did appreciate is there wasn't like a cliffhanger. It wasn't like a best of both worlds thing, but they left it on an emotional note between Ed Mercer, the captain, and Kelly, the first officer, about whether they would reignite their relationship, which to me, I'm just like, oh, do I really want to see this? I actually think it was probably done in the most mature way I could ever expect from like Seth MacFarlane.
Right.
So I was actually pleased with where the show left off.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I think what I've found over the course of watching this, you and I didn't particularly care for the premiere.
Right.
I think there's a number of lowlights, but I would say the last 6 out of 7 episodes, they kind of figured out what they were trying to do. And I think the last 6 out of 7 have been far more consistent than what preceded that.
Right.
So, I mean, my overall review is I think The Orville is perfectly watchable, but it's mostly one of those shows that I'd fold laundry while it's playing on in the background.
Right,
you know?
Right.
So I understand why fans like it, and I understand why people do like the characters from this and why they kind of feel like this is kind of one of those comfort food sorts of programs. So, look, no judgment if you dig the show. It's just not quite for me.
Right.
But, Cam, I have a bit of a wager for you, though.
Uh-oh.
So we've had the Ortonville report for the last 12 weeks, right?
Okay.
I want to do the Orville report here. For those who don't know, Cam's the V that Cam always gives at the end of the show stands for his middle name, Varel.
Well, it's just Varel. It's not
I don't care. The Orville report sounds much better. I'm going to get you to watch the final episode of the season.
Oh, no.
Yeah, and I just want you to tell me how this stacks up versus the premiere episode.
Okay.
My opinion is, you know, I thought there was potential for this show to kind of subvert what our expectations are when it comes to Star Trek. I don't think it ever succeeded at doing that, but I think the key to maybe the finale was that I don't remember maybe one joke, and it was like, it wasn't like the show was trying to be like nonstop punchlines, which it was falling flat at. It just kind of what was a show for the sake of being a show, and I think it was more watchable. I'm assigning you to watch the last episode so you can come back in our Best of 2017 episode next week and just give your thoughts about where the Orville started and where it ended and whether you saw any movement at all. I don't know. For me, I thought it was a tiny bit above lateral movement in terms of quality.
Right.
But it's weird that I'm thinking that there's definitely lows throughout the string of episodes, and that I did find that they reached a level of consistency that wasn't necessarily there before.
Right.
So I've hereby assigned you to watch that. You'll have to come back with your thoughts, and we'll see where it goes from there.
Okay, well, that sounds like a party for someone.
Yeah, already.
It's kind of like watching Encounter at Farpoint and then watching The Neutral Zone, being like, so how was season one TNG?
You're like, well, you know, they took this character and they went there with that character, and, yeah. You know, oh, I see, that's a little different. Yeah. Okay.
Romulan showed up.
Yeah. Huh,
interesting.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, well, that should be something.
Should be something, Ken.
Okay, well, on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, jump on over to our Facebook page. We'll have videos up as well as discussions going about this week's podcast episode, so join us there. It'll be more fun to be had. And Tyler, we've got to nail down what our other commentary track is going to be, because we're overdue for that one.
Okay.
So I think we actually decided, didn't we?
Okay.
We won't reveal it on the air, but we have decided, and so I think we're ready to go, and it will be up on the
Can we at least tell them what series it's going to be from, or do you want
to... Yeah, sure.
Okay, we're going to do an original series episode.
Right.
Because we've already done one Voyager, two TNGs.
Yes.
So we'll do a TOS and...
And whatever the next one will be a DS9 one.
Yeah. No, let's do Civilization from Enterprise.
Okay. Maybe if for that'll be a wager where someone who loses has to do Civilization. That would be something. So I guess next week, we've pretty much said it'll be our best of 2017. So there'll be clips, but there'll be new content too, and, you know, talk about the year that just passed and all sorts of fun stuff.
Yeah, I definitely want to emphasize, like, there will be new content in that. So you don't want to miss out on that one, because we're going to be, like, looking at the year as a whole and, like, what it really represents for Star Trek and... Our own personal journeys throughout the franchise, Cam, and it was a busy year for you and I.
That's right. And there'll also be some bloopers that are really funny.
They always are.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
Okay, so you can also find us
Hey, Cam, can you do me a favor and say Rolaren?
Shut up. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm Cam V as in Varel Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's R is in Rolaren. Eporton.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed. In your heart, in your mind, I'll stay with you for all time. If I could, then I would. I'll go wherever you will go. Transfer complete.